Going to item 40.
Item 40.
40, right.
And 41.
40 and 41, correct. All right, so regard to item 40 for Christina Hallett, let's begin with staff report.
Chair Shunsa, commissioners, items 40 and 41 are two separate preliminary review reports for Christina Hallett, an Oak Ridge City Council member. As background, as the commission may be aware, the City of Oak Ridge has had a number of issues relating to its fire department and Fire Chief Michael Hansen. At a series of meetings this spring, the City Council considered terminating Fire Chief Hansen's contract, and in fact did so in April. One of the issues that arose in the City was whether the City Council would appoint an interim Fire Chief from within the department. And among the community, the questions were whether that would be possibly Ms. Hollett's husband, Scott, a longtime fire department employee. So with that background, I'll get to the first case, number 40, which is 19118 ESM. In the first case, the complainant alleged that in years past, when she served as president of the Firemen's Association, Ms. Hollett used the association credit card for personal purchases. The complaint then goes on to assert that because of her husband's position, she had a conflict of interest in any decision to terminate Chief Hansen and potentially appoint her husband as interim chief. According to Ms. Hollett, in December 2015, she did use the association debit card in error. It had been mailed to her house. As soon as she discovered it, she self-reported it and reimbursed the association. There were two separate audits done at the time. They found no additional stolen misused funds. The complaint on this matter was very vague. It had no specifics. Other than her admission of the one error, we have no information to infer a violation of 244040. With respect to the conflict of interest allegations, the council's actions in terminating Chief Hansen's contracts or hiring an external candidate for fire chief, which is what they did, those would be too attenuated, I think, to give rise to a conflict of interest. However, on two occasions, the city council did discuss, however briefly, the possibility of appointing an internal candidate. Councilor Hollett did not propose appointing her husband, but the discussions did give rise to a potential conflict of interest, and she did not make any conflict disclosure. There appears to be a substantial objective basis to believe she may have violated 120 on at least two occasions. We therefore recommend opening an investigation.
Okay, questions for staff? Commissioner Keene.
Thank you. Susan, did the discussion specifically mention her husband, or did they just talk about we need to get an interim and let's talk about viable candidates?
There was on one occasion one of the other city councilors did mention her husband. I listened to the audio of all of the meetings. It does appear that the discussion of hiring from within was very brief and that the council as a whole was pretty determined to move toward doing an external candidate, but certainly at one of the meetings, one of the other counselors was, well, maybe we should look at hiring from within, like Scott.
And in that case, then there was an action taken that they moved to look for an internal candidate or look for an interim?
No, the council, basically, this was during the discussion, you know, open public discussion period. There wasn't an action item, and the council never took any action to look in within.
So, assuming all of those facts, since there was not an action being taken, are we saying that during this discussion that Ms. Hollett should have said, I have a potential conflict, even though there was not an action in front of her?
Well, because the action, decision, recommendation typically when we look at how a city council, how any governing body engages in a discussion, a potential conflict could arise, even for the discussion. However, it is somewhat attenuated here in that they were just in this sort of general discussion area and there was no action item before them.
Thank you, and I just want to ask our legal counsel to remind us of the conflicts rules. Do they come into play even when there is not an action item? It's just a discussion?
I think we have applied them in those situations before, yeah, as the discussion and debate is an action.
Is it an action, though? If we were just... If it's an information item, or here it's a public meeting, it was a public meeting,
yes,
where the public was testifying. I'm just wondering what she is. I can see the benefit. There's no harm in saying, just want to put on the record that my husband, somebody mentioned my husband, however briefly, and I said Scott, or whatever his name is, and I just wanted to make note for the record that that is my husband. And if he were down the line, lots of conditions that might happen, if he were appointed, I would have a conflict. I can see that that would be a benefit to say that, and it might be best practice, but I'm asking, I guess, whether that is legally required under our conflicts rules.
Only if you construe any, and she did not participate in this conversation at all.
She was silent.
And I think maybe that is even a difference. If you are going to participate in the conversation, maybe we would construe action, but maybe when you don't and there's no action, it's a different conclusion.
Would Ms. Hollett participate or declare a potential conflict when there were actions taken?
The actions taken were to hire an external candidate, and she did not disclose any conflict. So that, I think, any conflict was so attenuated that it wouldn't require disclosure.
And her husband was never hired?
No.
Or actually debated?
No, they decided simply to stay with the external.
I'm trying to, what is the section? I'm trying to find the conflict section.
020.
Actual conflict means any action or decision or recommendation by a person acting in a capacity as a public official, the effect of which would be, and for potential is, could be, to the private pecuniary benefit.
So I see your action.
Yeah.
And then by not taking part in the conversation.
I think arguably you could say that's different.
Yeah. I guess I stand by the fact that I think it would have been better practice to state, just want to let you all know for the record, many of you know me and you know this anyways, but that we mentioned the first name of somebody, and that's my husband. So down the line, this might come up. I don't believe I have a conflict right now, but just in all transparency, I want to let that know. I think that's best practice, but I don't believe that in this case, that even assuming all the facts and evidence, I don't believe that it would rise to a potential conflict of interest, and I think that's why I'm not going to be voting in favor of moving forward with the preliminary investigation.
Thank you, Commissioner Keene. Welcome, Commissioner Mason.
Thank you.
We know traffic out there has been pretty nasty this morning, so thank you for persevering through it along with Commissioner Edwards and being here. We are on item number 40
thank
in
you.
The executive session. So, all right, any further questions for staff? Okay. All right. So, Ms. Hollett, this is your opportunity to say anything if you'd like to add
anything. I'm available here for any questions. I do want to say, this is a little intimidating being here, but I want to make sure you guys know that I have called and talked to Susan on a few occasions, and she has been very helpful, and going through this process has been a lot better than I had expected. I really had felt, you know, I'm going to be on the chopping block here real fast, and I have not experienced that. I actually experienced really good advice, but I do want to let you guys know that I do realize my potential and actual conflicts that could arise, and in that, when budget season came up, I actually made an initiative to have our attorney seek your written advice on how our budget process would work, and we did get that advice. I abstained from the voting process and the budget because I am aware of that situation. In this particular situation, I did contact our legal side and ask them about the voting on Michael Hansen's contract. There was not, in their recommendation, there was not a conflict on that. And then when the topic arose, the action item on the agenda was actually to hire an outside interim. There was never an action to hire an in-house person. The way that it transpired was pretty exact to what Susan's saying, and that was we were discussing the outside candidate, and one other counselor said, what about Scott Hollett? And I think the city administrator gave an answer, and there was no further conversation on that topic. We did have executive session to discuss two outside candidates that we had already interviewed, and the executive session was just on those two persons' qualifications, and that's all the further that went. And I do have counselors that said they would speak on my behalf to make sure that you guys are aware that that is the only thing that was discussed, and our attorneys were present.
Ms. Alpha.
So thank you very much, and I do agree with everything you've said, and this is really attenuated. However, I do want to point out that if there's going to be an action on an outside person, that could affect an inside person. That action, you know, potentially could affect that person as well. So.
Agreed.
All right. Any questions for Ms. Hollett? Yes, Commissioner Fisher.
Mr. Chair, just quickly, I did read your letter, Ms. Hollett, and thank you for sending that in, and as well as our staff work, obviously. I just want to say for the record that I appreciate the explanation you provided about the use of the credit card being a mistake and your attempts to rectify that mistake.
Thank you.
And that strikes me as a fairly critical act on your part to have done that.
Yeah.
Because that sometimes rises to a problem, in my view, at least as an Ethics Commission member. So thank you for that. And I just wanted to say for the record that I think Ms. Hollett's letter deals with that issue pretty straightforwardly, as does the staff report, Susan. So thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Mr. King.
Thank you. And Ms. Hollett, I just, in augmenting what I just said, I want to say to you, I think as the legal counsel, I've been sort of parsing out a close question whether or not there was a potential conflict. And it's very easy to satisfy the ethics rules about potentials. You really just state on the record that you may have a potential conflict. You know, basically, I just want to let everyone know here that my husband is on the committee that's on the fire department, and we've been kind of talking about whether to do an internal or external hire. So just for the greatest transparency, I just want to put that on the record. You can still participate after that. And so I would just advise that you do that in the future. It does sound like you've been very cognizant and trying to comply. And in this case, I think because you didn't participate in that conversation, that you didn't violate the terms of the law that require you to state on the record your potential conflict. But you might as well just in the future to avoid going through this whole thing.
So wholeheartedly agree.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Holland? All right. Well, I will entertain a motion. Commissioner King.
I move to dismiss the complaint in item 40.
Okay. There's a motion to dismiss. Any discussion on the motion? All right. With that, we'll go to a roll call vote. I would be approval of dismissal. So, roll call, please.
Commissioner Starr?
Aye.
Mr. Edwards?
Aye.
Mr. Fiskum?
Aye.
Mr. Keene?
Aye.
Mr. Mason?
Abstain. So I didn't hear the whole case.
And Chair Sosa?
Aye.
Right.
Motion passes 5.
Fortunately, we have 5
yeah.
voting.
Okay. I was doing numbers.
Okay, very good. So, item number 40 is dismissed. Item 41, please.
Item 41, case number 19-124 ESM. In the second case, the complaint alleges that at a city council meeting, Christina Hollett lied to protect her husband from possible disciplinary action, including termination, that she had orchestrated a plan to terminate Fire Chief Hansen and then lobbied for her husband to be appointed as interim fire chief. We noted that at the meeting in question, the city council was not considering any action to discipline or terminate Scott Hollett, and Ms. Hollett's statement at the council meeting would not give rise to a 244040 violation. With respect to the allegation that she was lobbying for her husband to be appointed fire chief, there is insufficient information to infer that she used her official position to lobby for her husband's promotion. We therefore recommend that the commission dismiss the complaint.
Any questions for staff? Ms. Holland, did you want to say anything in regard to this matter?
I think I put everything in my letter, but if you guys have any more questions, this was kind of a silly one in my opinion, but
it
needs to be taken seriously, I guess.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Holland? I'll entertain a motion.
Move to approve staff recommendation.
Okay. All right. Any discussion on the motion? Go to roll call vote.
Commissioner Starr.
Aye.
Commissioner Edwards.
Aye.
Commissioner Fiskum.
Aye.
Commissioner Keene.
Aye.
Mr. Mason.
Aye.
Chair Sosa.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously.
Ms. Hollett, thank you very much for being here.
Thank
we
you guys
much
very much.
Thank you.
Interesting listening to all your other discussions.
Have a great day.
Thank you guys.
Does anyone need a break before we move to
Dr. Shirish?
Okay, 5 minute break. That's a 5 minute break. So we are back in executive session in regard to item 45, Dr. Ramat Shireshi. So we'll begin with staff report.
Vice Chair Sosa, Commissioners. Dr. Shireshi was the president of Portland State University and a public official when relevant events occurred in this matter. At its last meeting, the commission voted to open a case upon their own motion based upon a news article in the Oregonian which alleged possible violations of Oregon government ethics law. The four areas examined during preliminary review were allegations that Dr. Shireshi may have misled trustees when negotiating the pay raise for himself. Second, taken official actions concerning the sale of PSU's presidential residence that could have had a personal financial impact on him. Number three, he accepted a flight and resort stay paid by a private party in excess of the gift limits. And finally, he may have used PSU funds for his private research project. There were a lot of records obtained from PSU, and Dr. Shireshi's counsel also provided several records. Many of the records were redacted pursuant to public records exemptions for attorney-client privilege, conditional exemption for information pertaining to a donor or potential donor to a public university, and the exemption for personal information. Other redactions were not identified as to the reason. The commission has subpoena power only during the investigation phase, and if this matter is moved to investigation, the commission would attempt to obtain some records which were unattainable during this short preliminary review period. Information appears to be sufficient to show cause that a substantial objective basis exists for the belief that a violation of Oregon government ethics law may have been committed by Dr. Shireshi, and therefore cause exists to warrant an investigation on three of the four areas covered in the preliminary review report. Information is insufficient, however, to warrant investigation as to the allegations that Dr. Shireshi misled the board when seeking a salary increase. The report is in your meeting book with a recommendation to move to investigation for possible violations of ORS 244.041, prohibited use of office, ORS 244.1201C, conflict of interest, and ORS 244.025, the gift limits. I wanted to note that there is a typo in the report for the statutory citation for the gift limit statute. It shows 244.125 at a few points, but that's a statute that doesn't exist, so it should be 244.025. Dr. Shireshi and his attorney, Steve Berman, are here and would like to address the commission.
Thank you, Ms. Gould. Before we move forward, I do just want to say in an abundance of transparency that I do know Mr. Berman personally as a fellow plaintiff's lawyer, but don't feel that that in any way impacts my ability to preside today. So.
Oh, and I'm sorry. I wanted to say that over the transom last night, we received a letter from Jordan Schnitzer concerning this case, and I made copies, and you have that in there. At your seat here, agenda item 45.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Gould. Are there any questions for staff at this juncture? All right, I see none. Ms. Berman or Dr. Shreshi, whoever would like to go first.
Chair Sosa, I'm going to do the typical thing where I babble on for a couple of minutes and then Dr. Shreshi has a statement that he's prepared that he'd like to read to you.
Thank you.
I want to be clear, I've mentioned this in a couple topics that we've hit on the last couple of times we've been here. I'm Dr. Shreshi's lawyer. I do not represent PSU, and I want to be clear about that at the outset. And I really want to thank Ms. Gould and the professionalism and openness that we've had over the last 45 days in communicating, getting information back and forth, and keeping the channels of communication open. And my experience with this commission consistently has been that staff is working diligently within very strict time constraints, especially on the preliminary review stage. There's a lot to digest, and we appreciate the work that she put into it. She ran into the same problems that we've run into, and that I think one aspect that will remain if this matter continues, although I am going to ask you not to have it continue when I finish speaking, which is this attorney-client privilege issue that PSU has asserted over communications that Dr. Shreshi had with PSU's in-house counsel when he was president. PSU has taken the position that those communications are privileged, they have asserted privilege. Dr. Shreshi, although he's no longer with PSU, does not have authority to waive the privilege. And so we're being very cautious about that. I spoke with Ms. Gould yesterday, and so that I didn't want to do any kind of fast, tricky stuff here. And I mentioned there is one place in the report that I took issue with that we discussed. It's on page 21, and the statement says the PSU records indicate that there was enough question in the mind of PSU legal counsel to notify respondent that in so doing he may have been violating the ethics laws. And one of the things we discussed is because the commission has not seen the contents of those communications, mm-hmm. that is an inference that can be drawn, but I just want to be clear that, in fact, there is nothing before you in the evidentiary record that says that there was a communication from PSU's in-house counsel to Dr. Shreshi that he was violating the laws. I think it's a reasonable inference to be drawn, but I just want to be clear that there's no information about what the actual substance of those communications was in the record. And we discussed that. The other thing that we discussed, and really the one thing that I'm going to focus on today, is the gift limit. As the report indicated, there are a number of topics raised in the Oregonian article. Most of them fall outside of the commission's jurisdiction. Of the ones that do fall within the commission's jurisdiction, there are a couple that there was a finding that there was not sufficient cause to go forward. There are three remaining issues where the report is recommending that you all open an investigation. The first involves a trip to Bohemian Grove that was paid for by a major donor. The other two involve continuing research with a graduate student and Dr. Shreshi's participation in discussions about whether the university should sell the presidential residence that he was not living in. I only want to talk today with you about the gift limit issue and the question about whether Jordan Schnitzer's taking Dr. Shreshi to Bohemian Grove counts as a violation, or if there's evidence that could be a violation of the gift limit statute. And I'm only going to speak for, uncharacteristically, I'm only going to speak for about two more minutes, and then let Dr. Shreshi speak with you. Dr. Shreshi took a trip with Mr. Schnitzer to Bohemian Grove in July 2018 at Mr. Schnitzer's invitation. Mr. Schnitzer is a major donor to PSU, has been for a number of years. Under the gift statute, for a gift to be prohibited, the gift giver, the statute says, could reasonably be known to have had a legitimate I'm sorry, a legislative or administrative interest. And this is just, it would be an administrative interest. There's no legislative function that Dr. Ciresi served. And that's defined as an economic interest in any matter subject to the decision or vote of the public official acting in the public official's capacity as a public official. The commission's guide then goes on to clarify on page 28 what that means. And the commission explains, if the source of the gift would realize a financial gain or detriment from a vote or decision of a public official, that source has an economic interest in that public official. So it is whether or not the source of the gift, in this case Mr. Schnitzer, could have realized a financial gain or detriment from some decision that Dr. Ciresi could have made. In the report, the discussion centers around the fact that PSU owns property and Mr. Schnitzer's business is engaged in buying and selling property. And the report goes on to say, Jordan Schnitzer, as CEO of a real estate firm which owns residential, commercial, and industrial properties, including some in downtown Portland, may reasonably have been known to have an economic interest distinct of that from the general public in real estate matters subject to the decisions of Dr. Ciresi as PSU president. I received a call from Mr. Schnitzer on Tuesday afternoon, and we spoke, and he was very clear that his company, neither he nor his company, has ever looked at or participated in any decision regarding the purchase, sale, or acquisition of PSU property. I had been trying to get in touch with Mr. Schnitzer earlier. We spoke yesterday, and I apologized and said, I'm going to come with a letter from Jordan, hopefully tomorrow. I didn't have this until 11 o'clock last night. I did not want to do a fast one and say, oh, here's a piece of evidence you didn't have to consider. But I do actually think that this letter that I think you all have a copy of now is determinative on the specific issue within the commission's own guideline and within the statutory scheme. And so I think of the issues that you are considering taking forward to an investigation, this one issue about the violating the gift statute with the trip to Bohemian Grove, I legitimately think it's off the table. I think if we went to a contested case or farther down the proceeding and he were to testify, the evidence would be unequivocal that there was, he had no interest. He wasn't doing this for his purpose. He knew Dr. Ciresi. He's a major donor to the university. He wanted to take him to Bohemian Grove. And I think that's the end of it. He wasn't trying to get a benefit out of it or get anything out of it. So I would ask as we go forward, I'm happy to answer legal questions on this issue. Dr. Ciresi is happy to answer factual questions on this issue. But I did want to just call this to your attention, and I truly do apologize for the providing this late and the late notice and the late information, because it was, it's not consistent with how we have been exchanging information. It was truly not deliberate. It just kind of arose, and I flagged it last night, and I got this at 11 o'clock last night, and I forwarded it to Diane this morning. So we're not trying to hide the ball, but I think it does kind of change the discussion on that gift issue. So and with that, I'll defer to Dr. Ciresi unless anybody has any legal questions for me on that, on the gift thing.
Thank you.
Good morning. Again, I want to thank you for this opportunity. And I never forget from the last meeting that Commissioner Mason mentioned that this could be an opportunity to clear my name, because nobody has heard my side of the story through all of this. So I know that I'm not permitted to give a long presentation, but I really want to give some background about the three issues that have been highlighted in the report. When I took the position of PSU president, this was my first position as a public official, because my past administrative positions were at the private, not public institutions. And also, I did not have the knowledge and familiarity with the Oregon ethics laws. I know that I got a brief, an hour or so presentation and discussions about a number of matters. One of them was the Oregon ethics laws. But I was not versed about the ethics laws of Oregon. However, I believe that I have not done anything in violation of the ethics laws. And if I have made mistakes, it was not intentional. And I hope the commission will come to the same conclusion. What I want to tell you is that PSU is a great institution, but when I took on, I really hit the ground running with the understanding that one of my number one priority had to be financial sustainability of the university, given its mission as an access university. So I was even cultivating major donors before I even officially started my work at PSU. But let me talk about the three items. I know that Mr. Berman talked about the Bohemian trip. I did not know anything about what Bohemian Grove is. And it was the invitation from Mr. Schnitzer, a major donor to the university, and I looked at it as an opportunity to get to know him better, and also opportunity to educate a larger public about PSU. My office, PSU Foundation, and even I believe the General Counsel, they all knew about this trip weeks in advance. They knew about the itinerary, everything. Nobody raised the issue of a gift until I came back from the trip. And at that point, it was raised, which is still, I was questioning why it's the case. But regardless, I went ahead and reimbursed Mr. Schnitzer so that there will be no issue whatsoever about this whole topic. The second item is about the presidential residence. I'm sure you all know that before I started at PSU, the previous president and the board had decided to sell, we call it the Z House, it's the Zenbauer House. So it was a decision that was already made. My contract provided me a housing allowance. I was not interested in living in that house. In fact, if I had any interest in living in a suburban house, I would have applied my housing allowance for that purpose. The key element is that university president is a 24/7 job. There are emergencies and unexpected that happens. And you need to live close by the campus because of those. I want to remind you, exactly a year and 2 weeks ago today, at 1:30 a.m., was when we had the campus shooting at PSU. These are the things that, because of those, you don't want to live a place that it's going to take you an hour to fight traffic to get to the campus. That's why I never looked at anywhere outside of the downtown area. And that's where, even now that I'm not president, I'm still living in an apartment in the downtown. So the idea that I had interest in living in the Z House was completely a wrong understanding. I had no interest in that. But I want to make 2 points. One is, the house was, I should say, an asset of the university. And as the president, you've got to really look at the best ways of financially long-term benefits of the university. So that was, I was looking at it as an asset of university. And there were a number of board members that were questioning the wisdom of selling the house. So there were mixed messages there too. But what I wanted was for a university, especially a university like PSU, it is always beneficial to have a ceremonial residence. Just think of it as a house of worship. It's an opportunity for president to interact in a closer way with the students, with faculty, staff, guests, the community leaders, the donors. And so that's what I had in mind, and that's what I was saying. And but when the general counsel told me that from
a... You can't talk publicly. Let's
okay. Anyhow, I recused myself from those discussions. I wrote an email to the board member within 2 hours of that notice, and I said, you need to appoint somebody else to be involved in that discussions. However, for the benefit of the board and the executive leadership, I felt it's my responsibility to share my opinion. That's why I wrote an email. Because the people involved, they have not been in a position of being a university president or somebody who's going to consider that position. It is very important to have that ceremonial residence. It means a lot to a president. That's what I was trying to convey in that regard. Lastly, the whole issue of research and graduate students, talking about something that has completely misunderstood. It's a good example of that. As you know, under my agreement with PSU, I was president, but also a tenured professor of engineering. Through my almost 4 decades of academic, either as a faculty or an administrator, I always have continued my research and scholarship. So even when I was in New York, I was conducting my research with students. What happens is that, which is a very standard practice in academia, when a faculty moves from one institution to another, they try to move their research so that the new students, the new faculty collaborators will benefit from the results that have been done in the previous institution. That was my intention. I wanted the new students and faculty at PSU to start from where we stopped in New York. And so I asked my former graduate students to build an experimental system, test it, make sure it's working, and send that over to PSU for the PSU usage. And so it was rational for PSU to pay for those supplies, the $2,500 or so. That's why this was done, and the goal was, when it arrived, I talked to the faculty, I talked to his graduate students. The plan was to continue. The research takes several phases from a concept all the way to something that would be for real. So I wanted to continue that. The other phases at PSU, that would have generated intellectual properties that would have belonged to PSU. That was the intention. And everybody at PSU knew about it, including the general counsel. And there was, nobody raised any issues at that point. But when I saw all of these, I said, okay, again, to make sure that nobody would raise any ethical issues, I paid for those. I reimbursed the university personally. So, as you can imagine, the last few months have extremely been difficult for my family and myself. I'm not planning to enter a public official position in Oregon, but I want to tell you that the experience with this commission has affected me tremendously. I learned a lot about the ethics laws of Oregon. I wish I had known this before, but nothing I did was intentional or, in my opinion, in violation of the ethics law. And I hope by the end of this discussion, we will come to the same conclusion and close this case. Thank you again for this opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Chureshi. Any questions? Ms. Chureshi?
I just wanted to ask Mr. Berman whether the PSU has asserted the attorney-client privilege with respect to the Ethics Commission. I know it did with respect to the Oregonian Public Records, but since some of these attorney-client privileged statements would seem to be to the benefit of PSU, arguably, I'm wondering if you've inquired again.
Commissioner Keene, I'm going to be two-step answer. I'm not sure how Ms. Gould got these records, if these were in a direct request to PSU or if it was a request for the prior public records production. I don't know the answer to that. When Dr. Chureshi got the initial letter, I had asked PSU's counsel whether we could disclose some communications, and the response was no. I have not since inquired with PSU's counsel as to whether they've changed their position, but in the interim, there have been two appeals to the both OPB and the Oregonian have requested other attorney-client communications regarding Dr. Chureshi from PSU. PSU has opposed those requests and has gone to the district attorney to fight those requests, and the district attorney has sided with PSU and said that there will not be disclosure. So the communications with me are no disclosure. The communications with the Oregonian with the DA are no disclosure. I have not circled back on these specific documents again to ask if they changed their position.
And I guess presumably if they were to waive it with respect to the Ethics Commission, that they would be waiving it with respect to the Oregonian. So, okay. That's my only question to Mr. Berman.
Okay. Commissioner Mason and Commissioner Biskin.
Dr. Chureshi, I appreciate your coming in again and your eagerness to resolve the matter. You know, obviously, if you're eager to resolve it, we're eager to make sure it's a thorough process.
Sure.
So with regards to the Schnitzer trip, you just stated that there were staff that had, you know, known well in advance of the trip taking place. So it was a work trip, in essence, because you're, you know, relationship building. Would you?
It was, but I claimed it as vacation because I did not want to have any issues whatsoever.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess that was my question, because if it was a work trip, you know, where you're, building a relationship with the donor, why did you feel that you needed to reimburse the trip once you, and when was that decision made? Because it sounds like the staff knew that there was a trip, that this was, you know, I mean, if your staff knows that this trip is taking place and is work related, and then you are reimbursing it afterwards, what's the thought process?
May I jump in for a second, because this gets to a touching area, but I think I can answer your question in a way that will satisfy you. The Oregonian reports that after he returned from the trip, PSU's legal counsel advised that the trip was a gift that needed to be reimbursed.
Was that accurate? There's a report.
I don't think I can answer without violating the privilege. I think I can say what the Oregonian reported and then that the trip subsequently was reimbursed.
Did PSU reimburse it, or did Dr.
Chureshi? No, I reimbursed Mr. Schnitzer directly.
And we provided a copy of that check this morning.
And that's the only, you know, when I look at the potential violations, obviously this is a full investigation, which I think is where I would lean towards voting on, just to have clarification. If it was truly a work trip, there's no reason to reimburse it. And then if it wasn't a work trip, then there's probably a violation based on the gift limit, even though it was reimbursed. Like, just looking at it, in a black and white picture. So that's why I wanted to, get your perspective on why that was reimbursed. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Biskin.
I don't want to step on anybody else's line and want to follow up on Commissioner Mason's comments, but that said, I'll go ahead. From a non-attorney's perspective, if we were to open a, if the Ethics Commission were to open a full investigation, does that act give us any ability to breach the privilege?
No. We can subpoena the records, and some of the things that were redacted in the records that Ms. Gould got were not attorney-client privilege. They were public records disclosure claims, allegations, and I do think there's ways to get information in this case that don't involve the attorney-client privilege. And honestly, the attorney-client privilege, maybe if there had been an allegation of a willful violation and we got evidence that the attorney had counseled Dr. Shureshi to do something and he had done the opposite or not done, maybe that would be very important. In this case, we haven't done that. And then unfortunately for Dr. Shureshi, if legal counsel told him that something was okay, that would go into the fine calculation, not even the ethical violation calculation. So this case it's difficult and it's awkward for both the commission and for Dr. Shureshi, but we certainly can get the information we need without that.
Without
the attorney-client privilege.
Without breaching that.
Without needing it.
Without needing to breach it.
Right.
Needing to propose to breach it, whatever they
are. Right.
Thank you.
Ms. Person. Well, Diane, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there are specific items that we had asked for during the preliminary review that we've been told by PSU that is only available through subpoena. So they will provide those with a subpoena, and as you know, during the preliminary review, we do not have the authority to subpoena any records.
Mr. Person, in a full investigation, if you will, that authority that does exist or does not exist is all.
Yes, the subpoena authority exists, but you can't. But they could quash it for attorney-client privilege as to attorney-client privilege
sure.
communication.
Thank you.
But I was just trying to point out, though, that PSU has agreed to provide information to us with a subpoena. That doesn't include the attorney-client privilege, but there are other things that we are asking for.
Just a quick follow-up. If I interpret what you just said properly, it would be that PSU, if under subpoena, would not necessarily move to quash it.
I believe they would quash any attorney-client privilege, but we had asked, as
yes.
you know, during preliminary review, we asked for people to voluntarily give us information.
Sure.
And I'm simply saying that PSU had told us that they would not voluntarily give that they would require a subpoena for that information. But
thank
they
you,
do
but
plan on.
You,
they do plan on. I want to say responding to the subpoenas that we produce.
Mr. Berman. Just to follow up, because I want to make sure it's clear to the Commission, we have not withheld any documents that we have. I'm focusing a lot on cooperation here because I know it's important to the Commission and it's important to us as well. And so I think the documents PSU would produce in response to a subpoena. Maybe the stuff that were redacted for the public records exemptions, but not the subpoena documents, which if we had those, we would provide them as well if we had unredacted versions of those.
Ms. Person, do you want to comment on that?
No, I just have one quick thing to say. On the idea of legislative ministry of interest, in this case administrative interest, that is something that I think we have talked about in the preliminary review that we would be looking at. But I don't just want to concede the point from this letter that there isn't any administrative interest. We do know through this case that PSU was selling real estate in the Portland area, and Gordon Snitzer could have been a buyer with that. But like I said, I don't know if that interest is there, but that is something that we would look at. But I don't want the Commission just to feel that just because he's never asked to buy anything from that there couldn't be that interest. And a residence like that is at 2.7 asking price, that is not something that's available to the general public as a whole. So there's a smaller group of folks that could afford that residence. And like I said, I'm not saying that there is the interest, but it is something that we would look at. I think the arguments that Mr. Berman makes are excellent arguments, and that would be taken into account too. So I just wanted to point that out.
Okay. Mr. King.
Thank you. I have a question for our legal counsel, and maybe that's what she was going to talk about, regarding the legislative or administrative interest of Harsh Investments or Mr. Schnitzer himself. Aside from the real estate, the statute says legislative or administrative. The regs say economics. Is it possible that there could be a legislative or administrative interest in having buildings named for oneself?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that, because it has to be economic according to the, and I think the statute says an economic interest distinct.
It says legislative or administrative.
Let's look at 244, where it says it defines it. And then there's the rule, too.
There's the rule. But the statute, and we've come up.
It says legislative or administrative,
distinct from that of the general.
And then we've said economic in the rule.
Correct. However, we've also had cases where there are. We have not said that, for example, nonprofits could never violate the gifts rules because they're not profiting economically. If an environmental group had an interest in certain legislation being more protective of the environment, they may not profit economically, but they would profit administratively if there was, or they would benefit administratively if there were laws passed or executive orders issued that favored their goals. And we have in the past seen those as legislative or administrative interests. So what I'm wondering is whether, I think one factual discussion would have to be whether the president of a university has anything to say about whether buildings are named after one, if there's appropriate donation. But if so, whether that might qualify as a legislative or administrative interest, thus triggering the gift law.
And our rule does say a decision connected to a source's economic interest, and I think you could even make the argument that that could be connected to status and prestige.
That's right.
And I also just want to remind the Commission, as I have to fairly frequently, that in the preliminary review phase, the standard is whether there may have been, and there's a case, Brian, that specifically says that applies to whether there's a legislative or administrative interest. In that case, they had brought up case law and said there's, under the case law, there's clearly no legislative or administrative interest here, and the court said not at the preliminary review phase. That might be relevant there, but here it's whether there may be. So again, it's a very soft standard. This is a major real estate developer, major donor. It needs to, in my opinion, be looked into.
And so I guess that's, if we move forward, I would ask that we not only look at whether there's a possibility of real estate sale, but this, I mean, Mr. Schnitzer's letter almost states it really well, that that's his main interest, or he's been such a big donor that look at all of the buildings that have been named after him, which does offer a certain legitimacy and prestige, which might be a legislative or administrative interest. I would want us to, I don't have an opinion on that, and at this point.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll call Ms. Ms. Berman.
I just wanted to point out, and this kind of, sometimes these laws get shorthanded, but the administrative interest is in matters subject to the decision or vote of the public officials. So there doesn't have to be necessarily anything pending. It's just what kind of decisions does this public official make, and does this person have an interest in those matters distinct from that of the general public? So that's how I interpret this. Not necessarily a pending decision.
If I may go back to Commissioner Keene's question, because I respectfully, strongly disagree with Commissioner Keene's assertion, based on the actual statutory definition of legislative or administrative interest, notwithstanding the rule, bankruptcy commission is also bound. But the statutory definition in ORS 244010 sub 10 is legislative or administrative interest means an economic interest. So I think that respectfully kind of gets to the starting point for Commissioner Keene's inquiry. It is an economic interest.
And whether increased prestige and legitimacy helps one's economic interest, I think, is something we would want to investigate. Otherwise, the statute would have said economic interest.
It says economic interest. It literally says.
Or it would have said financial pecuniary interest. I want to give legal effect to the fact that our legislature said the word administrative. And if it only means economic, then the words legislative and administrative are surplus, which, as we know, in statutory construction would be unnecessary. So giving full effect to the legislature's terms, legislative or administrative, and knowing that we have applied these laws to nonprofits who, by definition, don't profit, there must be more than just does one's bank account get a dollar deposit. I want to look at, and I would want to hear our general counsel on that.
Yeah, and my understanding of why it says legislative or administrative is to make it clear this is not just with legislators or regard to legislation, it is regard to administrative decision making as well. And it does say an economic interest, but you are correct that the nonprofits they do raise money even if it's not for an economic gain. But I do think it's got to have some pecuniary, but I think that the naming of building, we should look into that. That could happen.
I don't know. Hear about it.
We're in the preliminary review phase. This is really preliminary. We have someone who has a lot of clout and influence in Portland and a lot of probably things we might not even know about that we haven't looked into yet. And again, that's why the standard is so soft, because this is just if there's something here to investigate. And making decisions, legal decisions right now is premature unless we can say definitively 100% that there isn't.
Mr. Person.
Yeah, so I just real quick. As you can see from our report, and the reason I signed this report is that this is one of the questions that we do want to answer in an investigation. I just want to point out that I know you guys all know this, but sometimes we need to be reminded this is a 30-day process, and I appreciate Mr. Berman's accolades to Diane for trying to go through the materials, the highly redacted materials, and try to make some sense of them, but you know, to be honest, I mean, you can't get through all that material in such a short amount of time. And so we haven't done a long enough investigation to tell you if there is that interest, but I will tell you that that will be part of the report that comes back is determining whether there is that interest. I mean, I think Mr. Berman's right that it all pivots on that interest for the trip. I'm also curious to know, and I'm sure we'll find it out in investigation, is the reimbursement, how that amount was determined for reimbursement. And I'm sure there was a methodology that happened there, but I don't think that's been pointed out either in this report. So, again, I just want to remind people it's 30 days trying to get a report to you both on a very, with a lot of information to try to get through. So.
Dr. Shreshi and then Commissioner Edwards.
Sure. I wanted to mention that and reiterate, during that trip or during my whole time as president, there was never a discussion between me and Mr. Schnitzer or his company about any transactions. So whether there are other things, be it before or after, during my time, there was never any discussions of that nature. The other thing is that, as you know, it's a very common practice at universities, naming of the buildings after others, U of O, OSU, they all have it. So it's nothing unusual.
Just to the executive director's point, I think, well, first off, I would say one of the things I appreciate about the commission is oftentimes the information that's brought to us in preliminary review either answers questions or brings up more questions, and it's clear to me that this has brought up more questions, and for that reason, I'm supportive of the staff's recommendation. But to the executive director's point of sort of limited accessibility for the scope of certain properties that should be looked at, I would hope in the investigation, we know that Mr. Schnitzer has looked at properties for other uses, and so I think there could be a connection with a property that's on here and movements that we've seen recently from this individual, and I think that there, so it certainly gives me question that I think the direction that Mr. Burson suggested has a lot of credibility, and I would want to hear about that in a report as well.
All right, I have some questions. In regard to the issue of the Z House, Dr. Shresha, I understand that you were receiving a stipend. You were not intending to move in. You got a stipend, then the stipend increased because the cost of housing was more than anticipated. But then there's a lot of material where you're involved and you are wanting to discuss with the folks whether it's going to be sold, whether it's going to be kept and maybe turned into two properties, whether it's going to be rehabilitated. You indicated today, though, that you had no intention, even if the thing had been rebuilt or renovated, you had no intention of living there. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And many of the things that are communicated, these are people thinking. It wasn't anything that I had communicated. I know that there were discussions even in the Oregonian that I had asked for a huge architecture. Mm-hmm. None of this is true. And what I wanted was, again, looking at the long-term benefits of the university. There was no offer on the property, and it was the question of what should we do if there is no offer on that. And part of it was that maybe we should look at making some minor modifications to make it more sellable and marketable. Those discussions came up, but nothing to the extent that was presented.
Well, just to clarify, there were no offers initially. There were
yeah.
subsequent offers.
Yeah.
Okay. If you had decided at some point, if the property had been rehabilitated and you had moved in, what would have happened to your housing stipend?
That would have stopped. In fact, it would have been back to what the former president was. He did not receive any housing stipend, but he was living in a president's residence. So it would have been reversed to that one. But that would have required changing of my contract with PSU. But all of those, when you think about the timing of it, were beyond my time, not just the 2 years, right? Because these things take time to materialize. So that's why anything that I was talking about the future of PSU, the future president coming to PSU. It was beyond my time.
Despite your housing stipend, were you still coming out of pocket every month to pay for your housing while you were president of PSU?
In terms of the out-of-pocket, no, it was the only reason for the amendment to that was in fact, maybe it's of help to make some clarifications. The original $6,000 that came up was because it was costing around $70,000 plus for maintaining the Z House. And so the board back calculated that maybe if we give $6,000 a month of a stipend, it's the same. The difference was that 70 plus wasn't an income to previous president, and therefore he did not pay tax on that. Whereas for me, it became an income, and the net of that income would have been less than the rent that I was paying. So that's why that modification and discussion came about. But it was barely making, it was a break even.
Okay. And that was my question, because when I read this, I thought, okay, well,
your stipend was later increased to, what was it, $9,000?
Yes.
I think. So, hypothetically, if you were going, if you, the cheapest property you could find that was suitable was $10,000, mm-hmm. and your stipend, despite the increase, is only $9,000, and you're essentially losing money, you're coming out of pocket every month, and you then have an interest in having this president's house rehabilitated so you can move in and stop the loss, there's some pecuniary gain there. So that my question was whether or not the stipend did in fact cover your housing once it was increased.
Sure.
It did. Okay. Next question I had is, there's a section here that talks about a patent on the research that you had brought over from New York. Did you have a patent on that?
There was a patent issued on the original concept. But as you know, patent is just to protect the idea, to make it something that is feasible. It takes a lot of research, and there was going to be a lot more IP that would have been developed at PSU, and those would have belonged to PSU. That was the conversation I had when all of that discussion was taking place.
So assuming that this product had ultimately been developed and gone to market, would you have seen a pecuniary benefit from that?
The key part is, first of all, I have almost close to a dozen patents. I have never taken any of it to commercialization. That's not my intent. My idea of research is to develop new ideas. Hopefully, especially students may want to take it and go to the next level. That wasn't my intent at all. Hasn't been. As I said, I have had several patents.
I know that wasn't your intent, but I'm saying if it ultimately had gone to market, and this is a product for, I think, soles of shoes for diabetics, presumably there would be some need for that in the marketplace. Would that have ultimately accrued to your financial benefits?
It would have benefited PSU more than me personally and the students of the PSU, because to develop that means I would have had collaborative faculty and students that would be working on bringing it to that level. I wasn't in a position to do that, but whoever would have taken it would benefit, but PSU would have been the first beneficiary.
Okay. All right, any further questions? Yes, Ms. Alba.
I just wanted to point out on the Z-House, one of the things that I thought the report pointed out to look into is some $450,000 gift in a sale potentially that would go for a new president's residence, and that was one of the pieces of information that the staff would investigate.
Mm-hmm. Yes, by the way, I wasn't aware of those and the final discussions and so forth. In fact, as I was reading the investigator's report, those were news to me.
Any further questions or comments? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion.
Move forward to accept staff recommendation.
Okay. We have a motion to accept staff recommendation and proceed with full investigation. Any discussion among the commissioners on that? Yes, Commissioner Fiscom.
Chair, I was prepared to make that motion as well. But I have mixed emotions about all this. I'm compelled in part by the risks of our 30-day clock in preliminary review, which doesn't allow us, understandably, to get enough information to satisfy us on at least the three issues that have been mentioned, not to mention the issues about administrative, legislative interest, and economic interest and such. There's a risk, I think, in an action that we may be prepared to take here if it is in the affirmative, which is that someone who hears about this may assume that we have found violations. Sometimes my friends in the media assume that when we act to investigate. For me, we are investigating. We have not reached a conclusion. That's why we're investigating. So for me, the operative word is may. Something may be involved. We have not confirmed that it is, in fact, if there is an alleged violation, that it has actually been a violation. That's what our process we might enter would determine. So the operative word for me is may. And frankly, if we proceed with this, I hope this can resolve this issue for all parties, including those who've been living with this for more personally than I for several months. So I'm prepared to vote yes when the moment arrives, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Commissioner Edwards.
Just to Commissioner Fitzgum's point, I also support the motion and also am increasingly have feelings about the portrayal in the media around actions taken by this commission. And it may be worthwhile for us to consider as a group whether there's benefit to actually proactively releasing media statements on our decisions so that we can clarify for them what exactly occurred during the meeting and give them the necessary information for what they would use in print. So that, I think, is separate than this motion, but I think that that's a conversation that we should have because it may help us, I think, to make clear what the commission is doing and what message should be used to educate the public on what was done.
I just want to be really clear on the motion to accept staff's recommendation that the last statute is actually 244.025.
Okay.
So just make sure that's on the record.
For myself, I echo what my fellow commissioners have said, and I also appreciate Dr. Shureshi for you, the toll it takes to have this kind of continue to drag on. But I do think that there are questions that were raised here today that I think you need to look into, despite the school's best efforts. She has a very limited time frame in which to look, and so I think giving her that extra time to look into those things. I'm, as you can tell from my question of Ms. Gould, I'm particularly interested in the patent question and to what extent he would benefit financially if this were to be commercialized, because he was using public resources, at least initially, to help in those research efforts, even though they were ultimately paid back. So with that, I would support the motion.
Mr. Chair, just one quick addendum. I appreciate receiving Mr. Spencer's letter this morning. I understand the timing was not of the choice by the respondents. I think the very existence of that letter, there is more to do. That's another reason for us to proceed, in my judgment. So,
any further discussion? All right, with that, we'll go to a roll call vote.
Mr. Stark?
Aye.
Mr. Edwards?
Aye.
Mr. Fiscom?
Aye.
Mr. Keene?
Aye.
Mr. Mason?
Aye.
Chair Sosa?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go back up to 31.
Yeah, I think we've got...
Somebody else here?